Hi, I'm Angie Brown, and you are listening to the Being Luminary podcast. The podcast where I sit down with everyday, but by no means ordinary thought leaders to talk about being luminary in life and in work. Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Being Luminary podcast. I am recording a special little episode today because we are in the pause between interviews with amazing everyday but by no means ordinary luminaries. And so I wanted to give you a really pithy, practical episode on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And this podcast is going to be focused on recruitment. So for all of you who have been scratching your heads about your recent recruitment drive, I know that if you're listening and you are working in an education institution, particularly a school, then you have probably just done your last round of recruitment, official round of recruitment for the year ahead. And so this might feel like it's reaching you too late, but it's never too late, friends. And for all you listeners who are not coming at the Being Luminary podcast from the education institution perspective, then this episode is going to be full of juicy tidbits. I would say that I have now officially lost count of the number of people who reach out to me for support with diversity, equity, inclusion, who really have as a core fear the idea that their organisation is not diverse enough. And perhaps the even deeper fear is that even if their organisation were really, really diverse, that it may not be as inclusive as it would need to be in order to stem the attrition rates of people who come from marginalised groups. It was really interesting that a couple of years ago, 2 years ago, when we were in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, race was obviously the really itchy subject. It was the hot topic. It was the one that everyone was kind of dancing around and interested in and sensitive to and focused on. And in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, people began to look around at their workforces, and I think they began to ask themselves some quite searching questions about diversity. I think for the first time in a long time, people began to gather in staff rooms and staff kitchens and offices and around the board table and start to ask the question, well, where are all the black and brown folk? And when they'd asked that question, they began to ask even more searching questions. Are the black and brown folks in this organisation working in roles as cleaners? Are they the kitchen staff? Where are they all at? If they're in middle leadership roles, why exactly is it the case that they haven't yet been able to make that progress through to the most senior levels of the organisation? And these questions about where the people were the sort of stirrings of we need to diversify our workforce. Although what I might have heard at the time was, Angie, can you help us? We need to get more diverse people into the organisation. And I have said it before and I'll say it again, friends. People are not diverse, but organisations and teams can be. People are not diverse because if people are diverse, who are they diverse from? When we say people are diverse, we're often restating the status quo. So for many organisations, once they started asking questions about diversifying the pipeline of applicants to jobs on the grounds of race, they then had to ask themselves about belonging and inclusion. Because for so many people and so many organisations, they realised that their anti-racist work was really to be found wanting. And so at this moment, they rightly turned their attention to not just how can we diversify our team? How can we diversify our organisation? How can we diversify the pipeline of people applying to these jobs? But also, What's our organisational culture for supporting the people we currently have? What feedback do we have from stakeholders about how well we have been doing in creating a sense of belonging and inclusion for them? Now, what happened about a year later when Sarah Everard was murdered? Sarah Everard was obviously murdered following an awakening that had already been taking place in our society, in schools, in colleges, on university campuses, about the prevalence of sexual assault, sexual violence, and harassment that many women were facing in education settings and in offices and, you know, modern day Britain. I often cite in my training the Everyday Sexism collaboration with the trade union associations, the trade union representing millions of workers in the UK. And that piece of research, that survey finding that the modern day British workplace is a site for sexual assault, sexual violence, sexual harassment for many women. And so in the wake of the murder of Sarah Everard, many organisations began asking questions once more about equity for women and men in their places of work. I noticed my coachees continued to talk at that time about what it felt like was a real lack of opportunity for them to break through to the very top level of their profession. And this was not because some faceless man was barring entry, but because we have all colluded organisationally to create workplaces that are agreed upon a set of parameters. And those parameters continue to make it difficult for women to progress as far and as swiftly as their male counterparts. And I want to say that again, we have all colluded in this. I remember my part in the collusion as a mother, making assumptions that my workplace would not be able to withstand the questions that I might ask of it. Could it accommodate me, a working mother? I remember the assumptions, the collusion, my part in the collusion when I was a head teacher, the assumptions I would make about people who were parents, who were interested in shared parental leave, the false set of assumptions that we all make about the inflexibility of our workplaces often. The thing is, with the organisational focus on race coming as it comes on the back of the murder of George Floyd, or the organisational focus on women and men in the workplace coming as it does on in the wake of the murder of Sarah Everard, is that we end up playing this game of DEI whack-a-mole. I've talked about this before. And the problem with DEI whack-a-mole is that it reacts to situations that are happening out there in the world and tries to course correct as a consequence of those external events. It's not prepared. It's not already secure. And the problem with something that isn't prepared and isn't secure is that it cannot be safe harbour for anybody. And just a reminder, what we're doing around here is we are becoming luminary organisations. Organisations that are able to, in shining their light and in having shone a light on themselves, evidence that they are safe harbour for people who hold protected characteristics or marginalised identities. So as we play the game of DEI whack-a-mole, we realise that every part of our DEI strategy, every part of our approach in the creation of a diverse workforce, every element of that recruitment and retention strategy needs to be intersectional if it's going to be safe. It needs to be all-encompassing if it's going to be safe. Because without that, one group or another will be overlooked. If we don't take an intersectional and all-encompassing approach to DEI in our recruitment and retention drive, one group will be overlooked. And in so doing, we will be reasserting existing narratives that exclusion is somehow a necessary evil. It's a byproduct of focusing on race. It's a byproduct on today focusing on the roles of women and men in the organisation. Unfortunately, our focus over here on sexual orientation means that we're going to have to exclude your narrative. And that cannot be if we're committed to luminary practice and being safe harbour. Now, I know that when I throw words like intersectional around, there are a group of people nodding and agreeing that we need to be thinking about race, and we need to be thinking about ethnicity, and we need to be thinking about gender and sex. We need to be thinking about disability, sexual orientation. We need to be thinking about all of those things when we are working out what to do in our next recruitment drive. We need to be thinking about considering the impact holding an intersectional identity might have on candidates' experience when they apply to work with us. We need to be thinking about the touch points with our organisation in the recruitment process for somebody who is disabled and also identifies as LGBTQ+ and also identifies as a person of colour. But I want to shine a light for a moment on a few other areas that I see being overlooked, because I think we're all quite savvy at the protected characteristics. I think we've all got quite good at it. I think we all think we're quite good at it. I just want to ask you to consider for a moment whether there are other areas in which your organisation could still do better, could still be more luminary. So, what I see at the moment, places that people could do better, seem to shake down to areas like maternity leave returners. So I would say, can you go and check and ensure that you're not discriminating against maternity leave returners? Have you made sure that you are actively encouraging those maternity leave returners to apply for jobs in your organisation? Like really, really focused on them. In fact, broadly speaking, you want to be thinking about how in your use of language and your choice of images and intentions, the intention with which you craft that job advert, that you are signalling to those people who are married or single, those who are carers or parents, that you want them in your organisation and you look forward to welcoming them at interview. There's something about the intention that we have here and the picturing the people who are coming towards us that really helps us with that language. Another area I see that we overlook and I'm really interested in is how we attract candidates from a wide range of socioeconomic backgrounds and also candidates who have a really diverse range of educational experiences. So, do your recruitment adverts indicate that candidates will be more or less likely to succeed if they have attended a Russell Group university? Are there markers of class or privilege in the text or the images that you choose for your recruitment campaigns that might put certain people off applying? And if there are and you like your reasons, then great, but maybe don't employ a DEI consultant to ask you to work out what it is that you could be doing differently to diversify the pipeline of people coming towards you. Because if you like your reasons, then be luminary in sticking to those reasons. In so doing, you will demonstrate that you are not necessarily safe harbour for everyone. And if you like your reasons, then fine. If you don't like your reasons and you think, hang on a minute, there is something in here that is a distinct marker of class and privilege that I'm not happy about, then change it. And the third area that I want you to think about is when it comes to recruiting for a really diverse team, is whether you are inadvertently focused on a particular style of leadership or way of working or way of thinking or way of communicating that thinking. So is there a language that you subtly use that talks to an in-crowd, possibly an in-crowd who have read the same books as you or others in your organisation, or an in-crowd who kind of hang out in the same spaces or maybe have the same views about pedagogy, philosophy, approach to customers? Are you in that subtle use of language also actively discouraging outsiders who don't get that, who don't get that lexicon? Again, if you like your reasons for recruiting people into the organisation who like the things you like, who look like the people who are already there, who you think will be a good fit, in inverted commas, for the established culture, then you'll get what you've always got. And your efforts to diversify your pipeline may remain stubborn. But then own that, I would say. And I say all of this with love, no guilt, no blame, no shame. Whatever you do and however you choose to think about diversifying your workforce or the pipeline of people applying for jobs in your organization, I think the key is to know that this is not something that will just happen on its own. So throwing up your hands and saying, we just don't seem to attract a diverse pool of talent. That's not good enough, my friends. That's not luminary. We need to be active in our efforts. We need to apply our fine and beautiful and courageous minds to the complexities and the challenges. And the rewards that will come our way when we do will so outweigh the effort we have gone to. Now, I know, because I can see you out there nodding. I get it. You're thinking, great, thanks, Angie. So we need to diversify our workforce. But there is still the small matter of getting people interested in coming to work for us in the first place. How, pray, do we do that? Well, I have a few ideas for you. And these are ideas that I think will, along with you being interested in this work, just set you aside from the competition. So the first is collaborate. When you keep diversity in mind, I think candidates will be attracted to come and work with you, not because of what your staff makeup appears to be and the visible diversity you seem to have utilized in your recruitment campaigns or made use of on the day of interviews. Please tell me you're not doing that. I do not want to see a black or brown person wheeled out on the day of interview who is not a black or brown person that actually has agency and day-to-day engagement in the strategic development of the organisation. No, thank you very much. But anyway, I digress. Actually, candidates will be attracted to you because of the way your organisation operates in the world. So organisations that build collaborations with non-profits, with interesting luminaries, with experts in the field of diversity, equity, inclusion, with a whole range interesting thought leaders, those organizations that build collaborations with charities, with groups in the community, with parents that are interested in decolonizing, in removing power around, those organizations that have powerful collaborations, they will appeal to a whole new group of potential candidates for your job. Demonstrating that you have the willingness to learn new things from other organisations and to work with ideas beyond your existing pool of employees is exciting, it's luminary, and it certainly strengthens the case that you are genuinely committed to diversity, diversity of thought, diversity around the table to make your place a better place to be. So collaboration is the first thing. The second is recalibration. So we, most of us in our organizations, need to recalibrate. I talked about this in a newsletter. And government data puts the number of disabled people and people with health conditions who are of working age at 7.7 million in the UK. However, the gap between the proportion of disabled people employed and non-disabled people employed remains really, really high. And one of the barriers related to that gap is that organisations negatively view making reasonable adjustments to the workplace, as though the cost and the efforts required might not, again, in inverted commas, pay off. And just like the whole diversity is good for the bottom line argument, I think we really need to recalibrate and get in touch with the broader issue. Making reasonable adjustments to support disabled job applicants and employees is not just about upholding the law or about increasing our profitability through the way that we look to others. It's ultimately about making our workplaces better places to be for everyone. So when we recalibrate around the why we're doing these things, we see that our efforts to create a diverse workforce make for a bid towards genuine inclusivity and the benefits of this on everyone in the organisation and everyone who is going to come your way in the future will reverberate, radiate. This is really luminary work, recalibration around being better places to be for everyone. So we have, first off, collaborate. Second, recalibrate. And the third is congregate. I love the town hall approach to diversity, equity, inclusion. In fact, I love the whole kind of concept of a town hall. Everyone coming together, like that moment in the movies. Well, if you're anything like me, the Hallmark movie where we're in a model village somewhere in America and everyone gathers to discuss a matter of extreme importance to the community openly, and everyone has a piece to say and everyone gets heard. And I love this approach to diversity, equity, inclusion, getting everyone together to discuss matters openly, having key members of your organization available and able to take questions. That to me feels like the kind of workplace that is dynamic and resilient enough to manage questions and feedback. It feels like an elegant organization. A luminary organization, yes, but and there's an elegance there about leaders taking it, taking the heat, standing in it. And everyone gets to feel that they're part of something in which challenge and throwing ideas around is welcome. And so in practice, when thinking about recruitment and how we attract people towards us, I think we should be thinking of our recruitment drives as mobile town hall moments. In other words, we are creating spaces in which we can talk about our organization and our recruitment and the kinds of people that we're hoping to attract and have everyone gather around us and ask questions of us. I can see you shaking your heads and going, I don't know what you're talking about. What does it mean in practice? Well, here's an idea. If you could get potential candidates gathered on, let's say, because it's my social media of choice, Twitter, could you set up a QA session with your CEO or your most senior leader to answer questions about the culture or the climate of your organization while giving potential candidates a feel for your openness? Now, some of you are saying Twitter is just a nightmare. There'll be people piling in who are not relevant to the conversation. We don't have that level of resilience. I'm not up for it. Okay, so maybe something that's a little more closed, a little more intimate. Could you do that same QA session on an Instagram Live or on a Facebook Live or even on a closed Zoom room? If potential candidates were gathered on Facebook, and you know that they're hanging out on Facebook because everyone's hanging out on Facebook apparently, how about your HR team host a Facebook Live so that people can just find out more about you there? They're on Facebook anyway. All they need to do is to see that X or Y organization is holding an open Facebook Live so that people can find out about what it's like to work for us. And maybe they'll hop across and maybe they'll be given the opportunity to ask those questions that they've really wanted to ask and get them answered by key people in the organization. Advertising information sessions or webinars on Instagram and getting them booked up on Eventbrite could attract even more people where they already are. They're already hanging out on Instagram. And for the early adopters or the luminaries out there, you could even try hosting a moderated room on Clubhouse if it still exists, or Twitter Spaces. I haven't used it, but you could potentially be communing with a whole new audience of people who love the fact that you are able to flex and be agile and diversify your thinking about finding people. As I keep saying, we can do difficult things. And from my vantage point, this work, this effort to collaborate, to recalibrate, to congregate with people, this is not so much difficult work, but it is work that's going to require energy. And it is work that's going to require intention. And it is work that is going to require focus. And if any of my people are listening to this podcast, and I know you are, you have energy, intention, and focus in spades. So good luck getting your next recruitment drive underway. And if you need help in getting any recruitment strategy or any DEI strategy heading in the right direction, you know where to find me. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you next week, friends. Bye. If you would like to take a luminary approach to leading on diversity, equity, inclusion, then you must check out the Luminary Leadership of DEI program, where you will learn how to lead strategy and enhance the experience of inclusion for all those who work and are served by your organisation. We enrol each quarter, so to get on the waitlist, head to www.angelabrown.co.uk/luminary-leadership-DEI. I can't wait to see you there. Thank you for listening to the Being Luminary podcast. I would love to hear your thoughts on the podcast, so please do leave us a review. Each month, I will be picking one of our reviewers to get a free laser coaching session as a thank you. And remember, if you know a luminary or an everyday thought leader who would benefit from listening to this podcast or who would love to be featured on the cast, then please do share it with them. This episode was presented by me, Angie Brown. Original music is by Martin Ostwick. The series is edited by Big Tent Media and produced by Emily Crosby Media.